Welcome to GVC Unplugged, a podcast made by employees for employees. Hear interviews and discussions with coworkers, stay informed about GVC news and projects, and catch up on the latest news and happenings at the co-op, and more. Let's get started.
Hey, GVEC team. Thanks for tuning in to the GVEC Unplugged podcast. You've got Carolyn Morrow, Employee Development Manager, here, and it is my privilege to host this month's episode devoted to honoring those members of our GVEC team who have served in the military. On today's Veterans Day podcast, we have Duncan Wallace, GVEC Support Analyst, John Schrader, Senior Communications Technician, Graham Hopman, Executive Manager of Customer Energy Solutions, and Anthony Ramirez, Associate Security Engineer. So each of these gentlemen represent various or different military branches. And so because they each have a story to tell, I'm going to let them introduce where they served and how long they served. So who wants to start? They're all pointing at each other. Graham, would you like to start?
Sure. Carolyn, thank you. I'll start. Good morning, GVEC. So I joined the Air Force in February of 2001. Inactive reserve. I commissioned in 2003. And so I was in the Air Force for, just about 13 and a half, almost 14 years. And when I got out in 2014.
Great.
All right. I guess we'll move on to me. Good morning. John Schrader here. I was in the Army. Went in and before a lot of y'all were born, 1985. I was in for 10 years. Let's see, all the places I'd been. Been out in the sandbox in the Middle East and Jordan and Egypt. Went to a little bit of Arizona desert too. A little bit of California desert. Anyways, I was in about 10 years. I got out in 95 when I got ready to go to school. So that's about my tenure there.
Great. Okay. And Duncan?
I was in the Marine Corps from 1994 to 98, and then in the Navy from 99 to 2006.
So you're unique, Duncan. You've served in two different branches there. You want to tell just briefly what happened there and what made you move from one to the other?
I believe the term is Shanghai. I completed my enlistment in the Marine Corps and then was out for just about a year. I was looking around and ended up back in the Navy or in the Navy.
Okay, great.
Just looking for another job and ended up going into the military again.
Gotcha. All right. And Anthony.
Yeah. I was in the Marine Corps in 2001 and got out in 2008. I was in Afghanistan in 2004 and 9/11 happened after I swore in. So I already knew where I was going when that happened. So
that's amazing. Thank you. So I have so many questions for you guys, but I want to start off kind of on a light note. What are y'all's nicknames for each other? I mean, the branches that you serve in. I've heard a little bit of it as we've been, setting up this morning.
Hey, Flyboy, why don't you start?
There you go.
So nicknames for the other services. This is a
keep it clean
family-friendly podcast here. I got to think about that. That's a good question, Carolyn. John was talking about the Air Force earlier.
Yeah, Flyboys.
Flyboys, yeah.
Of course, you got the Jarheads.
Well, yeah.
You know.
Chair Force.
Mm-hmm. Squids.
Jarheads for the Marines.
Squids, Jarhead.
Grunts for the Army.
Ground Pounders.
Been called old ground dogs, pounders. Too, but...
Ground
Pounders. Yep.
Ground Pounders.
That's the artillery people.
Yeah.
Army aren't ready for Marines yet.
Yeah.
Never again volunteer yourself. It's the Navy.
Yeah. Leatherneck, Devil Dog.
Marines is muscles are required, intelligence not essential.
Bullet blockers.
Yep, bullet catchers.
I love it. That is awesome. Okay, so now that we got that out of the way, what was that last one, Duncan?
Those are the friendly ones.
Oh, yeah, right. Those are the family-friendly ones. Exactly. So I just kind of want to start off by going around and asking, why did you join the military? So what moved you to sign up? Anthony, let's start with you, unless you...
No, that's fine. I joined because my uncle was a Marine. Mm-hmm. Actually, I was going to go to college, but around 17 is when I had my first kid. So that was one of the main reasons why I went. My parents told me either you go to college or you either go get a job or go to the military, and I chose the military. So
gotcha.
That's why I went to the Marine Corps. One of the reasons why.
I think I was destined for the military from a kind of an early age. Dad, granddad, from as far back as we can remember, they've all been in the military, and it was just kind of not expected, but it was just kind of a normal thing to do.
Great.
Oh, I guess we're on me. Well, I wanted to get out of town, number one. I tried the college thing, and it didn't work out. And I'm kind of like what Anthony was saying, you know, I've got kin folks that go all the way back to the Revolutionary War. So it was kind of like again, not a requirement, but it was kind of understood that somebody was going to serve. And so we've got a lot of people in the family. I got a brother that served, and right now I've got three nephews that are in. So it's still an ongoing process.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. That's wonderful. It does seem to be tradition and legacy goes a lot with the military. So, and finally, Graham.
I kind of piggyback on what Duncan said. There was some history in my family. My father, both my grandfathers, several of my uncles had served, but I never felt this expectation or pressure from my dad or grandparents that they expected me to do that. It was more, I was in college and thinking about long-term, where am I going to go? What am I going to do? I knew I wanted to do something for the country, to give back to the country. And it kind of just felt like a natural path, I guess, to go and serve. Yeah. And I liked the idea of flying. I wanted to fly. And so the Air Force was kind of what I began to kind of focus in on. And the idea of traveling around the world, that was exciting to me. So that was, again, yeah, put all that together. And I decided to go.
So that segues into my next question very, very well, Graham. Thank you. What did you do when you served in the military? What was your job? So you were a pilot, right?
I was. I started as a navigator. When I came out of school up in Lubbock, I went to Texas Tech. I commissioned as a second lieutenant the day I graduated, and I was active duty from that day all the way through the end.
So the other guys are smiling and giggling at this point. I'm not sure what that's about.
I missed that. Well, I don't know.
So you said you came out as a second lieutenant?
Yes.
We had nicknames for those too.
Sure, yeah. There's lots of nicknames for second lieutenants.
Butterbar comes to mind.
Sure, yep.
I don't know what that means, and I don't know if I want to know.
It's kind of like if you put a third grader in charge of a high school class.
Yep.
It's kind of what it feels like.
I bet Graham did well.
It's kind of, I don't care how good a third grader you are, it's kind of like a third grader in charge of a high school class.
We had to pay our dues to earn some street cred and some respect as a young second lieutenant, for sure. But I went through a couple years of training, flying, eventually flew C-130s as a navigator for about 6 years, transitioned over to becoming a pilot, and then I flew unmanned aircraft for the last 6.5 or 7 years before I got out.
Unmanned aircraft. Interesting.
Flew MQ-1 Predators and MQ-9 Reapers. But yeah, so when I was in, I flying C-130s, I was kind of like John was saying earlier, I was in Iraq, Afghanistan, Pakistan, Turkey, all over the Southwest Asia, throughout Africa, the Horn of Africa. I was in East Asia a lot. Spent plenty of time in Europe, Germany, Italy, Spain.
Wow.
So we got to go to some really awesome places, see some really beautiful things, got to go to some places that weren't so beautiful and saw some things that weren't so awesome.
Yeah.
But regardless, nonetheless, those are memories that I carry with me today, and I was proud to have served during the time I did.
That's awesome. Thank you. All right, John, what was your job?
Well.
Or jobs.
Yeah. So I started off actually in air defense, so I used to shoot down his aircraft. of the other side.
Of the other side, I hope. Yeah.
I was in what they call the Hawk Air Defense. I did reclassify after 4 years and went into a different job. I actually went into air traffic control maintenance. So we were tactical. So we had ground control approach. I know you're familiar with that, IFR, whatever you want to call it. We had towers, we had radios, we had all of it in a tactical sense. Mm-hmm. And I did that up in the Great White North of all place, up in Alaska where it's cold.
Oh.
And electronics don't work too well up there sometimes. So it's a whole new experience. Forgot to tell about my time in the Guard. Anyway, I was in, of all places, a combat engineering company out of Camp Swift up near Bastrop. Oh. So we did heavy equipment repairing up there.
Interesting.
Three different jobs, I guess. There was others in the middle there that you got stuck with, but, you know, you did what you had to do.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I'm going to come back to Alaska because I feel like that there's some stories there, but let's move on to Duncan. Duncan, let's talk about your different jobs that you performed when you were in the military.
Essentially, I was a mechanic. In the Marine Corps, I was a hydraulics and airframe mechanic. So I worked on the Hueys and Cobra helicopters. So I did that for 4 years. We trained a lot and we got to go to Liberia one summer. That was pretty horrible. They called us up on a Friday and said, hey, you're going to Liberia. And we said, okay, where's that? Because then we had to go find a map and go figure out where it was. So they were about to overrun the embassy. Friday, we got the word, Friday afternoon. We packed everything up. Monday morning, we're on a boat heading to Africa, June, July, and August, right off the coast of Liberia, and it's right on the equator in Africa.
I would assume their summers are a little hotter.
They're hot. It's Africa hot. It's a whole different kind of hot.
Yeah.
That was my fun in the Marine Corps. The Navy, I was on an aircraft carrier. I was on the USS Constellation. A really old ship. It was commissioned back in 61. So we were holding it together with duct tape and bubble gum. We almost lost the rudder at one point because it actually rusted off. The bolt that holds it on actually rusted. You know, luckily it didn't fall all the way out. But I worked in the engine room, and the engine room on an aircraft carrier is two great big boilers that we operated. Big boilers, big turbines, and that was one of the engine rooms. There's four on a carrier.
Another hot place.
Really hot, yeah. The only thing underneath us was water. So we were the lowest thing in the boat. So most of our time was actually underwater by about 20 something feet. Yeah, it was really hot. Average was anywhere from 110 on the really cool days up to about 180. It's been 2 6-hour shifts, 7 days a week, till they turn the engine off, which may be months. But yeah, it was just really loud, pretty horrible, no redeeming qualities. Yeah, it was fun. We were just off the coast of Hawaii when 9/11 hit. We were flying air defense that afternoon from Hawaii over LAX. So we had planes that launched within 30 minutes.
Wow.
That were armored up and flying over to LAX to go patrol. That was the first deployment. The second deployment, we gave it back to them. A lot of the shock and awe stuff that you saw was from our carrier.
Wow. Interesting.
The hangar bay was completely full of bombs, and then 2 days later, it was empty.
So I know, Anthony, you said 9/11. Let's go ahead and get into your jobs. And then I had a thought that occurred to me while you were talking, Duncan. So go ahead and, Anthony, tell us your jobs that you did in the Marines.
I'm glad you saved me for last, because mine was the least impressive. I was a personnel clerk, so I did paying promotions and stuff like that when it came to my job. It's funny.
But very important.
Yeah, it's important when you have to pay the Marines. But when you don't pay them, then they get really upset at you. I actually was going to join the Navy, and they told me that I would most likely be on a ship. So I was like, no, I'm not going to go in the Navy. Lo and behold, I go into the Marine Corps, and they put me in a MEU, which is a Marine Expeditionary Unit, and I was on a ship. So that was my deployment, was on a ship. When we went on a ship, we went through the Suez Canal and in Malta. I was got to stop off in Malta. It's a little island off the coast of Italy. We were in Qatar, and then from Qatar we flew to Afghanistan, and then from Afghanistan we came back to Kuwait, and then we stopped off in Spain. After that, I re-enlisted, and I was attached to a reserve unit. It was an anti-terrorism battalion reserve unit. And in a reserve unit, you have to do like the Toys for Tots. If we got in calls about older Marines that passed away, we'd have to do the burials, and we'd even have to do what are called cackle calls, and that's when you have to notify the family members that they lost a loved one in the war that was going on. The whole time I was there, I did about four of them. Closest airport, because I was stationed in Amarillo, was Oklahoma City. So we'd have to drive to Oklahoma City and have the Marine there in his casket and bring him out on the tarmac and put him into the hearse and then drive back with the hearse, escort him. And we would do the 21-gun salute and
wow.
folding the flag and all that stuff. So that part really stayed with me. But those were the main jobs that I yeah. did when I was in.
I have a lot of questions that are popping into my mind. You were essentially payroll. Is that what you said?
Yes.
Okay. And you did that from a boat?
Yes.
Interesting. I find that fascinating. Do y'all find that fascinating? It seems like you would be in an office somewhere on land, not from a boat.
No, yeah, we had an office there on the ship. It was a USS Wasp. It was a LHD-1. So we had the Harriers that would go up and go off that way and the CH-46s. And we had three other ships with us. It was the USS Shreveport and the USS Whidbey Island. So those were the three ships we had with us.
Well, that's really neat that you got to visit all those places. Suez Canal? Oh, my. That would be really interesting.
Yeah. They would have an escort with us on the roads right beside the ships because you have this big canal and then this huge ship going down the canal.
Yeah.
So that was pretty cool.
I'm just curious if you all served around the same time. And I know John's probably not anywhere near 9/11.
No, I was in during the first Gulf War.
Okay.
Yeah.
But the three of you, it sounds like y'all were all serving at least before or shortly after 9/11, right?
Youngsters is what we like to call them.
So it occurred to me that you're on an aircraft carrier serving in the bellows of the aircraft carrier and Graham is flying planes. If your paths might have crossed at some point. And I thought that was interesting.
I'm sure that they probably did.
Yeah.
At some time or another. You know, if you were in the Persian Gulf,
mm-hmm.
I was in the Persian Gulf a lot.
Mm-hmm. And Anthony was there too.
Oh yeah. And like we flew 7 days a week. We didn't have days off.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd come out of Qatar, go to Kuwait, go to Iraq, come back down, go back around, up through Pakistan into Afghanistan. And so if they're on a boat down there, highly likely we were flying.
Highly likely. I think that is really neat that you guys, your paths crossed at some point. My own, and I'm sure the other people that are in this room that didn't serve in the military, I am just so honored to be in this room and thankful for all that you did. As I'm researching for this podcast and reading about it, I know that it's not enough to say thank you for your service because there is nothing I can do that would thank you enough for freedom. And that's exactly what you did. But just hearing what you guys did and you work with us is so cool. It is just the coolest thing ever. Let's hear some stories. I want to hear some of the fun stories about one of your funnest memories of, and y'all can just go at random. No need to go in order. I know that may be hard for military people to be at ease, but go ahead and be at ease and just tell a fun story about something that sticks out in your mind about when you served.
I've got one. So,
how did we know that it would come from John first?
Well, this one, you're going to get a kick out of this one. I was out at Fort Bliss in El Paso, Texas, and the space shuttle was making one of its little hoopty-hoops. This was back when it would still fly on the back end of a 747. And so it had landed at the Army airfield that was there. We had a second lieutenant that was trying to get what we call TCO qualified, which is a tactical officer. And he had been a real pain in the ass for a few weeks already. And so he had everybody staying late, which, you know, you're getting into a dude's off time where he can go out and drink and act crazy. That's a whole different story.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So we decided one Friday evening we were going to get even with him. And so the space shuttle had coming in and we had locked onto him, targeting the aircraft. And we had a guy down at our launch pads with a fire extinguisher and a trash can. And so we all had our headsets on. We're all listening. He's going through, you know, where the target was, how fast he was coming. And so he was sitting there. He locks on. He says, I'm about to hit the fire button. And we're all sitting there going, all right, let's do this. Hurry up. You know, it's beer time already. He says, well, all right, I pushed the fire button. Well, about that time, the guy down at the launch pad let the fire extinguisher loose inside the trash can with a hot mic. Like the missile went off and he's locked on the space shuttle. And so somebody was sitting on the microphone going, you just shot the space shuttle down. And he came flying out of the back of that command central. And he forgot there was a lip on the shelter, if you will. So he went from there, he hit the sand. We were cracking up. And it's like, this is what happens when you mess with the enlisted. And after that, they told everybody to go out and have a party and come back at 8 a.m. But he learned after that, don't mess with the enlisted people. So we thought that was pretty funny.
Hilarious. We were flying a general. A lot of the times when we were deployed, we use the term downrange. When you're downrange somewhere, you might grow like a we call them a desert stash. Desert mustache. But in the military, you know, you have
I was like, a stash? You desert stash.
But you have your grooming standards still, right? And you got to have your hair a certain length and your mustache. If you have one, you know, it can't go beyond the corners of your lips and it can't go over the top of your lips. It has to be just, you know, very particular about how it's groomed. And so when we were downrange, when we were deployed, sometimes you would just kind of let those standards kind of get pushed a little bit. And you'd grow a mustache that was maybe a little bit outside of regulation, if you will. And we would kind of try to push the envelope, see how much we could get away with, right?
Absolutely.
And but at the same time, we were just humping it every single day, 7 days a week, no days off. Mm. And so there were bigger things to worry about than a mustache that was a little bit out of regs. So I had this mustache that was clearly out of regulations. It was becoming like handlebars down here. It was way over my top lip. You couldn't even see my lip.
Wow. Graham, I'm having a hard time imagining.
And that. I had a bald head. I bicked my head. I used a Bic razor. I didn't have any hair. So I had this.
Oh, do you have pictures?
Oh, I have pictures. You bet. And so I had this animal that was growing on my upper lip, basically, and bald head. And so we take off out of the Persian Gulf region at an air base there, and we're flying to Pakistan. And on a C-130, that's a 4.5-5 hour flight, depending on the winds. And we had a 2-star general that was riding that we were taking to Afghanistan. So he came up front in the cockpit with us, just kind of BSing, and he's talking to us, getting to know us as we're flying. We get along. Long flight, a lot of downtime. At some point in the flight, he turns to me and goes, LT, that mustache you have there. And I immediately kind of start backpedaling.
Yeah.
Right? And I have nowhere to go.
Yeah.
But I said, sir, as soon as we land, I'll take care of it. He goes, no, that's not what I'm saying. That's one of the coolest mustaches I've seen in a long time. He goes, you boys just keep doing it day in, day out. Oh. And when you get home, you know what you need to do. And for me, that was actually really cool. That general could have lit me up, right? And could have read me the riot act. But he had enough perspective on what we were doing, kind of day in and day out. It was 100-plus degrees every single day when we were out there. And we were doing 22-hour days where our missions. And we'd come back and we'd sleep for 8 hours and then do another 22-hour mission.
Good night.
So he had this perspective. He goes, you know what? These guys are working hard. And so for me, that was kind of an inflection point where, as a leader, I took a lot from that, going, you know, sure, you can do these things if you really wanted to, but he chose not to. And he had big enough picture, big enough perspective. I thought that was pretty cool.
That's a really cool story.
Yeah, so that was a cool one.
Good story and good lesson.
Yeah, you bet.
I wonder if growing out the mustache was a way for you guys to control something, you know, just to let it go.
Yeah, maybe that, or maybe just a little bit of an element of expression that we could have. And it was a morale thing too.
Yeah.
And so when you're in some of these places, sometimes morale is not as high as you might want it to be. So you look for little things.
Right.
You have these little kind of wins, if you will. And if you can grow your mustache out just a little bit longer, even though it's a very little win, it's still a win. And it kind of helps you, you know, put one foot in front of the other and just keep pressing.
Because I think that brings up the next point. Anthony, did you have a funny story? Or
yeah, it's kind of a funny story. I'm sure these gentlemen know what I'm talking about, but every unit has one of those guys that's really smart, but doesn't have common sense. And our guy, his name was Adams, and he was the same rank guy I was a sergeant. He was really smart. Like, he had a really good ASVAB score, but he just no common sense at all whatsoever. My first sergeant, when I was at that anti-terrorism battalion, he was a crusty old guy. Mm. And when I say crusty, I mean you could see like the marks on his neck from, you know, it just being like just older. He was a tough guy. I remember him. The way you do the burials is you have a bugle and we have one person doing the bugle play and then another one doing the flag folding, and or two of them do the flag folding, and then our first sergeant was to hand over the flag to the wife or next of kin. I was doing the bugle first, and then I went to doing the folding, and we did it by seniority.
Wait, you played the bugle? That's cool.
No, that's what I'm getting at. So on the bugle, there's a little recorder in there. And there's a little switch you have to turn on, and then you hit a button, and it has like a 10-second delay, and it'll start playing. So I remember telling him, I was like, man, you need to make sure that you hit the switch when you're walking over there, and then you hit the button, because you could feel underneath the bell of the bugle. You hit the button and it's got like a 10-second delay. You put it up to your mouth and then you act like you're playing it. He's like, okay, I'll do that. So me and my friend went to go do the part where we're folding the flag. And my first sergeant motions for the bugle to play and nothing happens. And my friend was telling me, because we had walked back to the vehicle already after we've done our part. Mm-hmm. And he's like, how much you want to bet he's going to mess it up? I'm like, dude, why are you got to say that for, man? We're waiting, and like almost 10 minutes goes by, and my first sergeant, he had to finish the burial. We had taken two vehicles, and that guy was riding my first sergeant. You could hear my first sergeant yelling at him. He's like, you need to get into the other vehicle.
Oh, no.
He was upset, so we stopped at a gas station. My first sergeant went up to me because I was at that unit the longest. Because we always check the batteries because we want to make sure the batteries were in there, right? And we checked to make sure that the light was on, that you hit the button. And I had tested right after we had left because we used to call everybody our last name. There was no first name.
Yeah.
So he would say, Ramirez, the bugle work. And I said, yeah, I did, first sergeant. Poor guy, he got put on duty for like a whole month.
Oh.
And then that was a not completed burial. So they had to go back out.
Oh.
To do finish the bugle playing. It's kind of funny, but it's kind of a lesson. And our first sergeant always told us, when we went out there to do a burial, you have to do it perfect, because that was the last hoorah that Marine was going to have before they would leave us. So we took it all very serious. That was the kind of funny part in it, but it was a part of, you know, you always have to double check the things that you have. You always have to make sure that you have everything squared away. And that was one of the big sayings we had in the military, was you have to be squared away.
Squared away. Is it always a recording at every?
It depends. I think that some of the active duty that do funeral detail, especially on post, I think still do the regular, like a for real bugler. But I know when I did it, we had of course, back then it was a boombox. That's what we called them, those big stereos.
Yeah.
And we had a cassette that you started. And how you play taps. You would sit behind a tree or something like that and hit the button.
But this appeared to be a bugle.
Yeah.
Playing the sound. So I'm sure the family was thinking, just play it. What are you waiting on? Just play it, right?
I'd have people come up to me and tell me, that was so beautiful, that how you played it. And I'm like, thank you very much. I wasn't really playing it, but I took the credit for it.
Well, it makes sense. I mean, that's efficient, really. You don't need to have that many bugle players, because really there probably aren't that many bugle players out there that, you know, can also serve in the military. Wow, that's interesting. So I learned so much from that story. That's interesting. And by the way, listeners, if you have not had the experience of attending a funeral with military honors, it is so, the word that comes to mind is inspiring, because it inspires me to remember why these people have served. You can see it on movies, you can, you know, read about them, but until you attend one in person, it is very, very inspiring. Thank you, guys. Those are great. Good stories. So we heard some kind of funny stories and whatnot, and I'm sure you guys have some serious stories, and we can get into that. But first, I wanted to kind of dive into the question of, you probably had what life was going to be like when you joined the military. So I want to get your perspective on what that was. And then once you served, were your expectations realized? Was it what you thought it was going to be? So thinking about what you thought it was going to be, and then were your expectations realized?
Well, I know when I joined, I wanted to be like a hard charger and everything. My recruiter, he had told me to get some sleep on the plane, because he said for the first 3 days, they don't let you go to sleep. Oh, of course, I was too excited. So when we got there, and no video that you see will ever prepare you for what you're going to get into when you get to boot camp. And I had seen all the videos, and I watched Heartbreak Ridge, and you know, I was really gung-ho. I was ready to go. And when I got there and got into the bus, because it's a big bus, it's a white bus, they take us into MCRD San Diego. And actually, a cameraman came into the very back of the bus, and the drill instructor came up. He started talking to us. And I was like, oh, that's not that bad. He seems like he's pretty cool. So as soon as the cameraman walks back out, that's when all hell breaks loose. And they're screaming, yelling at us. And, you know, I'm looking at other guys and their eyes are like really, really big. And I'm like freaking out too. So we get off on the asphalt and they have these yellow footprints. They want you to stand on those yellow footprints at attention. And they show you how to do that and everything. And we start going through our process. We do the paperwork, the calls to the home and stuff like that. And I'm like, okay, well, I'm pretty sure we're going to be able to go to sleep. That didn't happen. So for 3 whole days, I didn't get to sleep a wink at all. And then the last day, the 4th day, is when they allowed us to sleep, and it was only for 4 hours. But that was probably the best 4 hours I ever slept out of my whole life. When I went through boot camp, you know, they break you down to your core. I mean, when we'd get up in the morning, we had to put on each specific item on in amount of time. And if you were at your cami blouse and you couldn't put it on, they would make you take everything off and then start over again. They would break you down mentally. I mean, you had grown men crying. You'd have them calling for their moms. And we had some of them, unfortunately, try to take their own lives because it was just too much for them.
Yeah.
They teach you real fast that it's about a team. It's not individual. Yeah. And when you talk to your drill instructor, they'll teach you how to talk to them. It was no I or I need to or I need this. The way you'd have to ask them something is drill instructor, staff sergeant, whatever your name is, recruit Ramirez, request permission to go to the head, sir. That's how you need to ask it. And some of my friends, they couldn't ask it right. So the drill instructor wouldn't let them go. So there was times they would actually release on themselves. I mean, I laugh about it now, but then it wasn't really funny. But they break you down to where you don't even think about yourself anymore. You're thinking about the team. You know?
Yeah, there's always a meaning behind that and a reason behind doing that, but it doesn't seem like it probably in the moment.
And then once you get into the fleet, it starts to change a little bit. You know, the ranks that you have there, it just depends on what unit you're in and how that higher rank person wants to treat you. Because you have to remember, a lot of these guys, they're in their early 20s and they're thrust in there to be leaders. Think of like a 22-year-old that's in command of a whole group of guys or a squad. And he's telling you to do this and telling you that. I mean, it's not the same as, like, I'm 38 now, you know, so I would be able to give him some information or wisdom. And right. I mean, what does a 23-year-old really know about life?
You're right.
So
you grow up fast.
Yeah.
Yeah, you do. Absolutely.
Yeah, that's one of the funny things is that, you know, the old guys are in their late 20s.
Yep.
That's the old guys. I think somebody said the average age on a carrier is 20. That's their average age. Got guys that are barely 19, came in close to their birthday. By the time they go through a little bit of training in the Navy, they could be on a carrier within a year in the middle of a war. And then still can't drink, still can't have a beer.
That's usually overlooked, though.
It is.
Is it?
That green card gets you privileges.
You know, when you come back, when you're 21, you've been at war for 2 years. You've been in the Persian Gulf. You've been on a carrier. You've hit, you know, different... You've been to Hong Kong and Sydney and Perth and, you know, all these little places. You've seen life. You've seen way more life than most people will experience. And you can barely order a beer legally. And then you come back and all your friends that maybe went to college, they're in junior college, doing whatever they're doing, and something's different. And you can't figure it out. They're like, man, all these guys changed. It wasn't everybody else. It was you. Yeah, you grew up fast. And there's really no way around it. There's no escaping it. Boot camp, like you said, it's designed to be one of the hardest things you'll ever do. You don't want somebody out in the middle of nowhere because on a ship, in the air, you know, as a mechanic, as air traffic controller, you don't want that guy in a combat situation, in, you know, when things break and things start moving fast, you don't want them to kind of break down. They don't have time to fix your feelings about it. You know, it is literal life and death.
Right.
That's one of the reasons of boot camp. One's the education, teach you how to be in the military. But the other is really to break you and to see if you'll break or where you'll break.
Right.
You will break. It's just where you're going to break. It's designed that way on purpose.
It is. Absolutely.
And that drill instructor, when he comes on the bus, you will address me as drill instructor, staff sergeant, so-and-so. And then there's this moment of pause. And then a WWE cage match doesn't come close to what happens on that bus.
Really?
It's fun all of a sudden, and it's big, and it's scariest thing some people have ever seen. And now you look back on it and you laugh about it. And you're like, oh man, we didn't know that was coming.
So you went through boot camp for the Marines. Did you also go through a boot camp for the Navy?
No. So because I had gone through the Marine Corps, it is part of the Navy. It's Department of the Navy. I didn't have to go through Navy boot camp.
Thank the Lord.
When I went into the Navy, I went through a processing unit. Basically, it's just a barracks, and they say, yeah, you know, go here and do these things. And you're kind of processing in versus boot camp. Unfortunately, I didn't get the lessons on how to dress or what clothes go with what. So I'm kind of mix and matching and choose your own adventure, what hat you're supposed to wear with what uniform. And I kind of missed that part.
Yeah.
Wearing the wrong hats with different uniforms. And they're like, what are you doing? I'm like, I don't know. Nobody's ever taught me how to do it.
Hilarious. What other stories do you have, guys?
For me, prior to entering, we weren't in a conflict. We had been in small skirmishes around the globe for a number of years after Gulf War I, but there was not an active, continuing major conflict. And so I knew I wanted to enter, like I was saying earlier, but I didn't anticipate there being this long, drawn out conflict. Mm-hmm. And so I entered in February of 2001 is when I took my oath.
Wow.
And, you know, eight months later, September 11th happened. So for me, it was interesting because as I was finishing my schooling up in Lubbock, as the days and months went on, it became more and more clear that this thing that was developing in a response to September 11th was not going away.
Right.
So prior to my enlistment, taking my oath, I didn't anticipate being in the Air Force and being in a conflict the entire time, which is ultimately what it became.
Yeah.
And so that for me was kind of eye-opening. Hey, I clearly wanted to serve. That's why I went in. But I was expecting, hey, there might be an event here or there. We'll go do some flying, go do some training. I'll get out after, you know, 6 or 7 years. But it very quickly became something else.
Right.
And so for me, looking back prior to getting in, that was something I didn't really anticipate, was being in a combat conflict for the entire time of service that I was active.
So looking back now, you know, having that vision of, are you glad that it worked out the way it did? I mean, it obviously gave you lots of leadership opportunity.
It did. I wouldn't say I'm glad it worked out the way it did. I'm thankful for the opportunities that I was able to have as a result of it, but I'm not glad that it was a war environment for that entire time. There were some tough times in there for sure, but I'm thankful for the opportunities that I was presented. And, you know, it's made me, in a way, who I am today, good, bad, or otherwise. And it's shaped who I've become. So I'm thankful for that.
Yeah. All right, John, what were your thoughts about going into the military? And then once you were in there, were they realized?
Before I went in, I was working. I was, like, doing general contracting, working on roofs, hauling hay in the middle of summer. It was hot, miserable, getting up early, working late. So to me, when I went to basic, you know, all exactly what y'all said happened. You know, they come in with the military alarm clock, you know, the trash can and a stick, and they beat it and everybody gets up. But I don't know that, I'm not saying it wasn't difficult. It was, but I think I expected it. My dad was he had been in and he thought it was still the old style. Mm-hmm. And so he's like, you don't want to go. You know, he wanted me to go somewhere else. But again, I needed to get away. And so, you know, I went in and I just made it what it ended up being. You know, you made it through boot camp and you went to your training. Fortunately, my training was 9 months long. So we weren't in that basic training environment. You know, we were in a more of a permanent party. And so, you know, you had rooms, you had roommates. I think we only had two people to a room at that point, but your job was school and PT. I mean, that's what you did. Permanent party. It's like they say, you go there, you do what you got to do. You go do your job, you get deployed, you come back, you just different things.
I'm not sure if I understand permanent party. What is permanent
party? Permanent party is where you end up generally getting stationed.
Okay.
That's not to say that's where you'll remain, because you may get deployed from that. Your permanent party may go, you know, you get deployed with them. That's where your spot is. That's where your house is, if you have one, things of that nature, your barracks, whatever it is.
Well, and that, was that in Alaska?
I was in a few different places.
A few different places.
Alaska was one of them, yes. Fort Bliss was another one. But from there, we were deployed. You know, we went out to Yuma, believe it or not, in that little hole in the desert.
It's a fun place.
Yeah.
Been there a couple times.
Hey, I got to admit, though, they did fix my truck. I had a transmission that every time you let off the gas would pop out of third gear. So we took it in there saying, I can't stand it. Our mechanics won't fix it. It's been 2 years. They fixed it in one day. So
sweet.
Good job, Marines. That's all. That's the only time you'll ever hear me say that, by the way. So anyway, and then, of course, you know, we were deployed over to the Middle East for a while. It is what it is, it you is know. Like Graham said, you know, it makes you who you are. The unfortunate part is, I don't want to say it's even unfortunate. My wife can tell you that there's some things that were just drilled into your head that to this day I can't get rid of. And I'm not talking memories. I'm just talking about the training, that this is how it is.
Yeah.
I'll be the first to, you know, sometimes I'm a little short with people and I'll tell them how I see it and move on. But you got to be quick and move on. Like you said, we're not here to, what did you call it?
Talk about your feelings.
Talk about your feelings. We're here to do a job. Do it and move on, or you're going to be dead. And unfortunately, that's kind of stayed with me. And I mean, even in the environment we're in, you know, you think about the electrical side of, you know, if you don't do this, you're going to die. That is an unfortunate shortcoming on my part.
Well, I think that is a real and present reality with people that serve in the military, is the very fine line between life and death. And it's a daily reality, mm-hmm. is what you're facing. I know Duncan was telling me stories about when you're working. You want to tell that story?
Yeah. I mean, going back to the Marine Corps side, we went to a funeral about every 6 months. We had a problem with helicopters that the engines would just stop, and helicopters don't glide, about every 6 months that I was in for 4 years. Either us or one of the other squadrons on base, we had one helicopter that our gunships went in and cleared a very small tree-lined area. So imagine just a little clearing in a forest. Went in, shot everything, cleared it. And then as they were leaving, they were a couple minutes late, and the 46, which is a troop transport helicopter, it's got two rotors on top, it was a couple minutes early. And they were about 200 feet above ground when they crashed. Mm. Everybody died. It was a weekend. Most people were gone. And they started knocking on the barracks and just getting anybody they could. And they drove us out in a field. And they grabbed a bunch of bags. And we put whatever was left of whatever we could find. We had black guys' arms with white guys' legs and Asian guys' torsos, and pretty horrible.
So what do you do from there? How do you cope with that?
Time.
Yeah.
It's just time. Sometimes you don't get over it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we've seen pieces and parts of people that aren't attached anymore up close. You know, you're dragging a big Ziploc bag through the forest looking for whatever hamburger steak you can find and seeing if you can piece it back together.
Yeah.
It's the world's worst jigsaw puzzle. Mixed in with a helicopter that's on fire and sharp and pointy in a swamp in North Carolina. The guy thought he would do some maintenance on the carrier. On a carrier, you can't run away. You're on a big ship and there's nowhere to go. You know, the next thing that's not floating is 1,000 miles away.
Right.
And we had 10,000 gallons of diesel pour out into one of our tanks, poured out into the bilge and caught fire. There's nowhere to go. You have to
put it out.
You go from operator to responder, you know, instantly.
Yeah.
You are your own first responder. Luckily, nobody got hurt after that. They did all their shutdown procedures and, you know, everything was just great. But yeah, it's pretty horrible.
Right.
I mean, death was, for us, we didn't have to go to war to have death right next to us. It was a constant reminder. Mm-hmm. every day.
Every day.
Yeah, what John was saying, I can echo as well. You know, there were 100 things that could kill you or more all the time. And just like, you know, Duncan was saying that, you know, that was one of the unfortunate realities about serving was the loss of life, the death. And it was when I was in as well, it was almost ever present. That was tough. And one of the missions that we flew as a C-130 was bringing remains out of combat zones. Our call signs when we flew were kind of standard issue call signs for the aircraft based on the mission we were flying. But if we were bringing remains out of the combat zone, our call sign became Angel Flight. Mm. We'd be Angel Flight 03, Angel Flight 05. There's actually if you're familiar with Rodney Crowell, he has a song called Angel Flight. And it's so for those listening, if you ever want to hear kind of what that experience was like, just look that up on Spotify or whatever your music player of choice is. But, you know, I can tell you we flew a lot. I don't want to put a number on it. Just a lot of American patriots out of Iraq and Afghanistan. You know, I can remember times where we would load up full honors presenting arms as the caskets were being loaded in the back of our C-130 and taken off at 2 o'clock in the morning. And there's a lot of radio chatter, running checklists, getting up, getting airborne, getting to 25, 28,000 feet and heading out. But, you know, it'd be 2 o'clock in the morning, pitch black, and you could hear a pin drop in the cockpit because the weight of what we were doing was very, very apparent. We knew that we had 10 or 12 young men and or women in the back, that we were their first leg of getting them home back to the United States.
Right.
So that was a tough mission, but also, you know, I don't want to say proud. It's not what we were. We were honored, I guess, to be able to help repatriate those young men and women back home and bring them back home. And so that was death was a part of my experience as well.
So thank you, Graham. That seems like a good stopping point to take a quick break. We're going to pause here and we'll get back in just a few minutes. Welcome back to the GVEC Unplugged podcast. Today we are honoring our veterans as it is Veterans Day in November. And so we are talking with Graham Hopman, John Schrader, Duncan Wallace, and Anthony Ramirez. I wanted to wrap up today's podcast with just a couple more questions and segueing into, we want to hear a little bit about maybe what was one of the hardest lessons that you had to learn, or maybe one of the biggest challenges that you had to overcome when you served in the military.
You've talked about the Angel Flights and you were on a funeral detail, and that was one I got stuck on. We were off post. We had an on post and an off post. It was a month long detail. And if there was a death, and we did the full, we had, you know, 8 pallbearers and the guy that was at the head, the seven rifles out there. We had the guy that played taps and all that. You never knew what you were coming into. We had one funeral I know where the widow got up and actually attacked one of the pallbearers.
Wow. Just out of grief.
Out of grief was a lot of it, you know, but you don't know that's coming. You know, you're up there, you know, there's a lot of details that go into that. You know, the flag being tight, you know, there's 13 folds. You got to do it just precise, even the way your shoelaces are tied, you know, whether it's right over left or lefty, but everybody had to be the same.
Wow.
But, you know, you realize that is that person's last thing for them on earth, basically, you know, that you're doing that for them. I mean, it's an honor to serve on that detail, just knowing that. Not all of them died in combat. Some died of natural causes. Some of them were just experienced in life. You know, they were old, so they passed on. I was glad I didn't get stuck on the on post because they were holding 3 and 4 a day. We usually did about 3 a week. It was hard. I mean, you know, to sit there, you got to listen to these people. You're trying to be military. You know, you're trying to keep that straight face and not do anything crazy, you know, and you never, like I said, like the one example, you know, you never know what's going to happen.
Well, and with your military training, if somebody attacks you,
yeah,
that could go real bad real quick.
I know for me, that was a challenging time for me.
Yeah.
Because we had an A and a B team. That way, if there were two separate funerals in a day, then one took one and one took the other. Because of the way things ended up falling, I was on the B team. Anyway, so A team, I was the backup, if you will. So I had to go to all of them. Mm. And just watching the people, you know, they're grieving and you're trying to perform a duty. And it ate me up.
Yeah.
At all of them. I couldn't, you know, I'd sit on the bus and come home with my head between, you know, going down, it's like, no. but what do you do? That's something you got to do. It's got to be done.
And that certainly is a challenge to overcome. Absolutely.
Yeah, it's tough. The first family we did that for, they were an Hispanic family. So my staff sergeant had to tell her in Spanish. And she was, of course, hysterical and was throwing things at him. And I was there too. I'm trying to kind of be the buffer and everything. You don't know how lucky you are or how much of an honor it is to do that for somebody that may pay the ultimate price for, not just for everybody here, but even for me too. Because that, I mean, the way we saw them, well, they were our brothers and our sisters. I mean, when you get into a fighting hole, that's the only person you're going to depend on, and they're going to depend on you. Just seeing that, that was probably pretty hard for me, because when you're younger adult, you kind of only think about yourself, you know. What are you going to do for yourself? What am I going to do this weekend? You know, that puts it all in perspective though, when you have to do something like that, because now you're not thinking about yourself. You're thinking about the burial and the send off you're giving that your brother, your sister. That was one thing we did. We took it pretty serious all the time, because I know when I pass away, I want to be honored that way too. Yeah, you know,
absolutely.
That was probably something that was kind of hard for me to understand when you're, because I was like around maybe 24 when I was doing that.
Oh my, Anthony, wow.
Yeah, I was about 24, 25. So when you're thrust in that, you're like, your mindset completely changes. It's not about Anthony anymore. It's about Sergeant whoever, or Lance Corporal whoever, you know, Corporal whoever.
You know, I could say, just like, you know, we've been discussing here, those have been some difficult times that sounds like all of us have faced in some way, shape or form, but it's not all bad, right? There were some times in my experience in the Air Force that were some really beautiful experiences, and I'm sure you all have some of those as well. I'd like to share a couple of those if that's okay.
Absolutely.
So, and go back to what we're talking about with like the Desert Stash, those little victories, those little wins that you can get even in difficult times. There were a couple times when we were flying back home, and we were somewhere between Ireland and St. John's, Newfoundland, just south of Iceland. And it was January. It was bitter cold. We're fighting a 100-knot jet stream in our face, so we're just creeping across the water, going very slow. Middle of the night. And we put on our NVGs, our NOGs, our night vision goggles, and we dropped them down. All the lights in the cockpit are off. And you look up, and there's the Northern Lights right there.
Wow.
Seeing that through night vision goggles, through your NOGs, was unreal.
Wow.
It looked like you could just reach out and just touch it with your hands. The colors were so vibrant, even off night vision goggles. Yeah. Just looking at it through the naked eye was unreal. And so those are moments for me where you could just take a brief pause, a brief victory, a brief win, and go, this is cool.
Yeah.
Like, this is really cool. There aren't a whole bunch of people that get to see this. So that was one for me.
And it was pre-iPhone probably. So you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you might have a digital camera, but
it's not going to pick it up.
It's not going to pick it up. Another one that was really cool. We actually, if you ever heard of St. Elmo's fire, it's a real thing. Mm-hmm. We had that happen to us, to come through the middle of the cockpit with just basically static electricity and energy coming through the plane. You can literally see it move along the plane. You're like, oh my gosh, that is super cool.
Wow.
Y'all were down in the Persian Gulf. I don't know if y'all ever saw the palm tree islands they built off of UAE. You can get on Google Maps, Google Earth, satellite image, and you can see those down there off of Dubai, I guess it
Dubai.
Was.
Yep.
And what are those?
It's a man-made island that looks like a palm tree.
Huh.
The shape of a fan of a palm tree. And I have a picture flying over that at 20,000 feet through night vision goggles. You can see all the lights that make the fan of the palm tree. It's really cool. So those are cool things about serving little wins, little victories that you can embed in your memory and mm-hmm. and go, that was a really neat experience. I'm sure y'all have some of those as well.
Yeah, mine was when we were on the Suez, and we went out there in the Suez. It was Zulu time. So it was like around 2100, which is 9 or 10. And the moon is so bright that you could look down the sand dunes for like miles.
Wow.
Just miles and miles that you could look down because the moon is so bright out there. You know, we did PT up there too. And because it takes like 2 or 3 days to get through mm-hmm. that whole canal. It's like long, really long. Those are some of the things that I remember too. And just being out there and looking up at the stars and seeing that. You really can't see that in the city.
No, you can't.
I was up in Alaska for 3 years, and you were talking about the northern lights. Man, they don't get any more northern than that.
Yep.
Seeing snow for 9 months out of the year, though, is a little old.
That after about tough. The
third week, I'm done with it. I think the other thing that I like from up there, and of course those that have known me any length of time knows my hobby is radios, ham radios, amateur radio, whatever you want to call it. And that's where the bug finally just bit me. And I got my ticket or my license, but we call it shoot and skip. And from up there, when the northern lights are going on, you could talk to Australia from up there with a couple hundred watts and a fiberglass whip. It was nothing. I mean, yeah, it was out of band. It was not quite of the, you know,
legal
side, but you know, they had one FCC guy in the whole state. He wasn't going to stop us all. I actually, at that point, was in the barracks. And I remember I had a vertical antenna that I stuck in the overflow pipe on the third floor because that's where I was at. And it's amazing with little elevation what you can do.
Mm-hmm.
The unfortunate part was one of your Chinooks came in there and decided he was going to do a little low approach and took my antenna out of there and broke it in 3 pieces, but put it back together and got back on the air. And he didn't stop me very long. But
Yeah, John, we were over the North Atlantic on the C-130, and we had an HF, a high frequency mm-hmm. radio on that plane, which is a half, the antenna was half the wavelength of the signal, and you could bounce signals basically off the atmosphere, off the ground.
Yep.
Wow.
And I actually called my dad. We were just off the coast of Shannon, Ireland, and I tuned up an HF frequency. I found someone on Freak that was in Oregon. So I was off the coast of Ireland on the radio talking to someone in Oregon who passed me through to my father in Texas.
What?
Yeah.
Was he a Mars operator?
He was Mars. Okay. It was Mars radio. So I get on the radio, Mars radio. This is Torque 03.
Yeah.
Wait. And eventually signal will come back. It was really cool. So those are experiences that, you know, I'll tell my son Rhett about when he's older.
Absolutely.
And those are fun type things. Mm-hmm. Hi, Rhett, by the way, if you're listening. but those are cool type of experiences where you're going, dang, this is really cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
When you cross the ocean, at some point you get in the middle. You know, you're going to it and then all of a sudden you're in the middle. And you realize you're in the middle of the ocean. You can see things. And I can only imagine what people thought about 1,000 years ago when they crossed the ocean, when the Vikings were doing their thing, and, you know, 500 years ago when people were crossing the oceans and stuff. You talk about at night, on nights when there's no moon, there is no horizon. It's just stars all the way down until the stars stop. And if the water's flat enough, out in the middle of the ocean, the water can get glassy flat. Mm-hmm. Called the doldrums. There's no wind. There's no wave. It's just flat. So you look like you're in a teacup. The ship's going through the water. It's just glass smooth. It's not rocking. It feels unnatural. And you're there at night. Everything just stops. The quiet. Nothing sounds right. The quiet. The stars all the way down to the horizon. And it's every star in the sky. Mm. It's what people saw 1,000 years ago, 10,000 years ago. It's what the night looked like. And you can see constellations that you can't see here. It's amazing. It's awe-inspiring. In the daytime, this was going to Liberia. We hit a pod of dolphins. So it was a very flat, calm day. The water is a different blue. It's a blue you can't describe. There's no name for the blue. It's just, it's this blue that just doesn't seem real. And the sky happened to be the same color. No clouds. So you feel like you're just in this blue snow globe. We hit a pod of dolphins. It's a super pod. And it was just dolphins as far as you could see. Wow. And they're playing in the wake of the ship. And the ship's just kind of, it's moving, but it doesn't feel like it's moving. You know, you can see the light going through the waves as the wake happens. And it looks kind of like a lens. And you can see, you know, 1,000 feet down in the water. And you realize, you know, you see it, but you don't realize it until you're kind of looking at the light play underneath there. That you're in, you know, tens of thousands of feet of water. And you can see the light 1,000 feet down. It's surreal. I mean, I can only imagine that's what an acid trip feels like. because it's just, it's not something you can describe. Right. What I'm saying doesn't even come close to the reality of what it was. So yeah, there's some surreal things that you can't describe. You can try and it just doesn't do it justice.
I think that kind of sums up this entire podcast. Is we're trying to get a glimpse into what it was like for you guys, but there are really no words to describe what you guys experienced, good or bad. And so that's, thank you for that. That is amazing. What can we do as civilians to either pay our respects, to honor you? What can we do to understand and to appreciate what you do or did?
That's a really hard one. I've kind of struggled with that over the years, because when you're in the military, it's only when you're out of the military that you get the perspective of being in the military. Mm-hmm. It's by far one of the hardest things I've ever done. I mean, it was incredibly hard and hot and nasty, horrible. I wouldn't wish it on anybody. But looking back on it, I'm proud of it. But it was almost just a job. It was an adventure, but it was a job. And I don't feel like I want to take credit for it. I don't want to stand up and beat my chest and go, hey, look at what I did. You know, I did this for you. And I don't know very many people that feel that way. I think there's so many more people in the company that were in the military that you would never know. Mm-hmm. So many more people out in town that you would never guess were in the military and did some of the things they did, seen some of the things they've seen. Thank you for your service. And I'm kind of like, okay, thanks. You know, you're welcome.
Does it make you feel awkward when people say that?
Absolutely. Every single time. And most veterans.
Is that across the board? Everybody's shaking their heads. So I guess I'll stop saying that, because I do say that. Because I want in some way to acknowledge it.
Well, I wouldn't go so far as to say that someone saying that it's unappreciated.
It just catches you.
It is awkward though sometimes, because mm-hmm. I don't always have the words. I mean, I can say, well, you know, I appreciate you saying that. Thank you. But the conversation, it could go so much deeper, right? Mm-hmm. And sometimes we may want to talk about it. Sometimes we may not. And so, but I mean, it's awkward, but I do appreciate if someone comes up and says, hey, thanks for your service. Well, yeah, I appreciate that. But I don't always have the words to really express
sure.
mm-hmm. what I'm feeling in that moment. And I don't know if that's the same for you guys or not.
I think so. I think people that are in law enforcement, firefighters, EMTs, they're around death. They're around all the horrible things that humans do to each other. They see a lot of the same things. It's a different environment, but they see a lot of that same thing. And for them, I think it's kind of the same thing. It's an awkward, it's my job. It was my job to go do these things. And it's hard to come up with an answer. I mean, there's stories I don't tell without alcohol involved. You know,
I think we've all had those kind of stories.
Yeah, they're in, some are harder than others. Taking credit for it, most people in the military or veterans, it's a hard thing.
Yeah.
I don't know if there's anything you can do.
Right.
Yeah, I would echo that.
Yeah. I understand we fight for freedoms, but I know one of the big things, you know, today's an election day, vote. Go out and vote, man. That's what we did it for you to have them freedoms to go vote. It's a lot of people died for that reason. We've seen how the other part of the world lives, and their freedoms are not there like That's they right. are here.
Well, guys, I cannot thank you enough for sharing your experiences. It's an honor to work alongside of you, and I hope that everybody out there in GVEC land will take a moment to think about what you guys have done. And I know that there are other veterans out in our family and our team. And so I do thank you for all that you've done today and in years past. And so it's been my honor to host this episode. I thought it fitting to end today's episode by playing the remarks from former President Ronald Reagan. This is a clip that was originally aired as a tribute to Memorial Day, which is not the same as Veterans Day. Memorial Day is a day where we honor those who fought and paid the ultimate price for our freedom. And so when I saw this video, I found it a good reminder of why we honor all who serve. And so we're going to play that audio clip now.
Sometime back, I received in the name of our country the bodies of four Marines who had died while on active duty. I said then that there is a special sadness that accompanies the death of a serviceman, for we're never quite good enough to them. Not really, we can't be, because what they gave us is beyond our powers to repay. And so when a serviceman dies, it's a tear in the fabric, a break in the whole, and all we can do is remember. It is, in a way, an odd thing to honor those who died in defense of our country, in defense of us, in wars far away. The imagination plays a trick. We see these soldiers in our mind as old and wise. We see them as something like the founding fathers, grave and gray-haired. But most of them were boys when they died, and they gave up two lives, the one they were living and the one they would have lived. When they died, they gave up their chance to be husbands and fathers and grandfathers. They gave up their chance to be revered old men. They gave up everything for our country, for us. We owe them a debt we can never repay. All we can do is remember them and what they did and why they had to be brave for us.
If you enjoyed listening to today's episode and would like to hear more episodes like this, reply to the HR podcast email to give us your feedback. The same goes if you have ideas on how we can make the podcast more interesting to you, or if you would like to join us on an episode. We want to hear from you. Be sure to subscribe to the GVEC Unplugged podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or Google Podcasts to be notified when new episodes are released. Take care of each other, GVEC team, and stay safe till next time.